coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The eyesore, formerly known as the Tri-State Mall near Claymont, appears ready for a makeover.
I think that just about everybody in Claymont is so happy that there's some movement there, that this property has been sold to folks who have shown an absolute willingness to do something with it.
Contributor Eileen Dalabrida offers a look ahead at what's next for the Tri-State Mall. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learn more about the mysterious illness killing birds in the First State and elsewhere, and begin our series of conversations with candidates for Rehoboth's Board of Commissioners. Plus, Arts Playlist highlights the latest exhibition at the historic Odessa Foundation. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Earlier this week, one of the buildings at the old Tri-State Mall near Claymont was demolished, raising hopes that new life may soon be breathed into a site that's long been an eyesore. But contributor Eileen Dalabrida reports what that new life ultimately looks like remains uncertain and may not be what area residents are hoping for. Her piece on the Tri-State Mall site's future is available at DelawarePublic.org, and she joined me earlier this week to discuss what she learned about what's next there. So, Eileen, let's start with a little backstory. What's the Tri-State Mall's history, and specifically, how long has it been kind of this shell of its former self?
Well, the Tri-State Mall had a relatively short life. It was founded in 1967, but never really got a lot of traction. People do have fond memories of the mall, but it went downhill pretty quickly. It had some real bad luck anchors like Value City and Kmart. So by the early, say, 2000s, it was really run down and very much in decline.
And is there anything still there at this point that's kind of left over holding out?
There is nothing at Tri-State Mall, and there is nothing at the Lovitz Furniture Outlet. The Tri-State Mall parking lot is stores with lots of lumber piled someplace from a furniture company that rents space there. And there is a very small, kind of tired strip shopping center with places. It's got a pawn shop and a check cashing place, a nail salon, a laundromat, things like that. It doesn't have any brand or marquee retailers. It's all small, independent people who are making a living there with what I suspect are very low rents.
Having that as a backdrop, who now owns this property and how long have they had it?
They've had it since June, so they're very new. They are based in New York. It's KPR, Katz Properties, and it's only their second property and by far the largest in Delaware. The only other property that they own in the First State is a Rite Aid in Dover.
And what are they saying about their plans for this Tri-State Mall site?
Well, I spoke with their VP of construction, and he said literally everything under the sun, that it has a really great location, ready access to I-95 and to I-495, as well as Neiman's Road. They are, at essence, retailers or retail developers, but in recent years, they've also gotten more into the industrial side and logistics.
And you mentioned logistics, and that obviously a very hot development choice these days. When you mentioned the site location, I guess, is that a major reason why a site like this could be considered for logistics, is the appeal of where it's at?
Logistics, as you said, is very hot. There's been a big shift in the way people shop. So these fulfillment centers, these warehousing and development places, they are really very hot these days in Delaware, located where it is, smack dab in the middle of the Mid-Atlantic, has been a primary site for a lot of development of fulfillment centers, and with Amazon and the boxwood plant and in Delaware City and in Bear.
And that kind of maybe flies in the face of what residents would like to see at this Tri-State Mall site, which would be something with more of a retail element, maybe something that's mixed use. So if that were the way the developers went, what could that look like? I'm assuming it would not be Tri-State Mall 2.0.
It would not. I don't think there are malls being built anywhere in America for the past 10 years. If it does have a retail element, I think that it would be mixed with something else. I do think that some retail would really fly there. Claymont is really underserved in terms of grocery stores and things like that. I think that I talk with people and they would like to see some restaurants. But as far as a traditional mall goes, it's not going to happen.
So how about local officials and groups like the Claymont Renaissance Development Corporation? They've been very active in trying to move redevelopment in Claymont along. It has not always been as successful short as they'd like. What's their take on what's next to Tri-State Mall?
Well, I think that the Development Corporation, as well as just about everybody in Claymont, is so happy that there's some movement there, that this property has been sold to folks who have shown an absolute willingness to do something with it. It's highly unusual for a company to start knocking down buildings before they have a plan in place. But Levitt's was so atrocious and had so many code violations that they took this extraordinary step as to show the community that we're here. We want to make this a better place. And so I think that they're going to look very seriously at the great assets of this place. I mean, it has all the infrastructure is there. It's got great road access. It's a really cool possibility.
And at 41 acres, it's substantial enough to do a fair amount of different things if you're interested.
Yes, and that's why the Renaissance Development Corporation really, and their boots on the ground, and they've been working very hard for a long time. So if they see the possibility for housing with a view of the river and all kinds of exciting things that could go on there.
So having said all that, is there any kind of timetable for work to get done on this site now that we've seen at least one of the buildings on the site come tumbling down?
That is going to happen very soon. They're starting the internal demo on July 19th, and then after that, they're going to knock it down and haul away the rubble. They haven't submitted any plans as yet to the county, but I expect them to take a quick evaluation of this, and they seem to be eager to get off the dime and do something.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dellabrita for her time on The Green this week. Her piece on what's next at the old Tri-State Mall is available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Contributor John Hurdle joins us with more on what we know and what we don't know about the mysterious deaths of birds on the East Coast and Midwest in recent months. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Since May, wildlife officials and scientists along the East Coast and in the Midwest have been tracking a surprising number of sick or dying birds, but remain baffled by the cause. Delaware has reported some cases, and this week, contributor John Hurdle takes a closer look at what we know and don't know about this puzzling illness in his latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me this week to walk us through what he found. So let's start with what we know. How long has this been going on, and what birds seem to be affected by this mystery illness?
Scientists began to get the first reports from the public in about mid-May, and the birds that are affected are really mostly common backyard birds, things like blue jays, starlings, robins, common grackles. And some finches, there's some evidence of finches are getting this disease as well. And what scientists are saying is that young birds especially appear to be particularly vulnerable to whatever this is.
So can you tell us a little bit about the symptoms? How would you know an affected bird if you happen to see one in your backyard?
Well, the symptoms are described as a swelling of the eyes and then some kind of crusty discharge from the eyes. Those are the physical symptoms. And then there's so-called neurological symptoms, which include erratic flight and stumbling. And so apparently whatever this disease is, whatever this illness is attacking the bird's nervous systems as well as their eyes.
So how widespread is it at this point? How bad has it become? And is it still worsening, do we know?
Well, there are 8 states where there are reports of these birds, including Delaware. It's unclear whether it's getting worse or not, and this is one of the things that shows how little scientists and ornithologists really know about this thing. And there seem to be some hope, let's put it that way, amongst the folks that I've talked to, that maybe the incidence rate is leveling off, that perhaps it's there isn't an increase in the number of cases, but that's very tentative, and I think nobody is actually drawing any firm conclusions yet about the course of this thing.
How about here in Delaware? What have we seen here in terms of cases?
Well, DENREC says that they have had about 75 cases, that's really only the number of birds that have been that they've been told about or that they've been physically given by the public, and so it seems that there seems to be some expectation out there that the numbers are probably significantly higher than that. I also spoke with Tri-State Bird Rescue, which is a non-profit based in Newark, and they said that they've had 22 birds with those symptoms passed to them. Now, I mean, these are sound like pretty small numbers, but there's evidence of a fairly high degree of official concern about this thing. The evidence for that would be that you know, you've got state governments, agencies like DENREC, who are working on it, are back at the beginning of the month. DENREC put out a press release saying, you know, alerting the public to this and issuing advice for folks as to how to respond to it. The federal government is also working on this. They're aware of it. The U.S. Geological Survey put out a statement back in the beginning of July indicating that they're aware of it. And an academic institution as well, the University of Pennsylvania's Vet School and Penn State University are also working on it. And so I think that even though the numbers in Delaware may look modest at the moment, I think that a lot of people are working pretty hard on figuring out what's really going on.
And I was going to say, I guess a lot of that concern stems from the fact that there's a lot we don't know, including what the cause is. Do they have any theories, or at least have they ruled some things out?
What they have ruled out is some pathogens which have previously been known to affect the avian population. Those would be West Nile virus and avian influenza. They are apparently not the cause of whatever is doing this. And the theory that the scientists have is that whatever this illness is caused by gatherings of birds, congregations of birds. So they have proposed, or they have suggested, a number of ways in which those things can be deterred.
You mentioned that some of those possibilities. What are experts here and elsewhere suggesting people do to mitigate the spread of this illness? And are we seeing some signs that people are actually doing these things to help maybe slow things down?
Yeah. Well, they are urging people to remove their bird feeders and their bird baths from their backyards, hopefully lessen the chances of transmission of this disease. And there does seem to be some indication that people are taking this seriously. I spoke recently with the owner of a business in Hokkesen, Wild Birds Unlimited, and that supplies seed and I guess other forms of bird feed to this gentleman's customers. And he said that he's been getting a lot of calls from people saying, well, that they'd heard these reports and what was his recommendation. They didn't know what to do. Since he's in the bird seed business, he's loath to recommend that people stop feeding the birds. But of course, he recognizes that there's an issue here, and so his advice anyway is for folks to go on the DENREC website or to call DENREC to get their recommendations for how to deal with this.
So, if someone finds a sick or dead bird, what should they do based on the recommendations that the public officials are making?
Well, if the bird they find is dead, they should get it somehow to DENREC. And then DENREC is sending the carcasses to the New Bolton Center, which is the University of Pennsylvania's vet school. They are doing diagnostic testing. They were not willing to say what, if anything, they'd found or what any conclusions that they had reached, and they just referred me back to the state. And if anybody finds sick birds, then the advice is to get them somehow to the non-profit Tri-State Bird Rescue in Newark, and they will try to revive them, but there is apparently no chance that they will revive them. At the moment, it does seem that those birds, sick birds, will die of this thing because simply they haven't found any treatment yet.
And as far as we know, this is just limited to birds, right? There's no impact on other animals, livestock, or people?
That's correct. The statement put out by the USGS earlier this month said that there's no evidence of transmission to people, livestock, or poultry.
Thanks to contributor John Hurdle for his time this week. His piece on the mysterious illness affecting birds in Delaware and beyond is available at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with the first in our series of interviews with candidates for seats on the City of Rehoboth's Board of Commissioners. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Rehoboth Beach residents vote August 14th to fill two Board of Commissioner seats. Four candidates are vying to represent the city as it grapples with new development, a tourist boom, and recovery from the COVID-19 pandemic. Delaware Public Media's Roman Battaglia begins our series of candidate conversations with the one incumbent in the race, Richard Byrne. Byrne has been on the board for 3 years and seeks to maintain a delicate balance between residents, businesses, and tourists.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today about your run for city, the Board of Commissioners again.
Yes.
Now, I'm not actually sure how long have you lived in Rehoboth Beach?
Yeah. Roman, thanks for this opportunity this morning. My wife, Sherry Wright, and I have been homeowners since 2002. We have been full-time since 2009.
All right. So you've been here... You've been in Rehoboth Beach for quite a while then.
Yes.
And, you know, for people who may not know you, I mean, what kind of experiences do you bring to being a city commissioner?
Yeah, and that is one of my themes, that I am running on experience. I'm asking people to vote for experience. I had over 30 years of leadership and management and administrative experience at two major universities, University of Minnesota and University of Maryland in College Park. I directed and managed statewide programs in each of those states in 4-H youth development, family consumer science and agriculture, large educational programs, which were collaborations of citizens and volunteers, young people, community organizations, and government agencies at all levels. I retired in 2008, moved full-time to the city of Rehoboth Beach. This is our only home. We are here year-round full-time. And since then, I've been very involved in a number of community organizations in terms of leadership. I have served as the president of the Board of Governors for the Sussex County YMCA. I've served on the statewide Delaware YMCA Board of Association. I'm president of my homeowners association. I've been very involved in Representative and Speaker Pete Schwarzkopf's Representative District Committee. I chaired that for 6 years. And in addition to that, I'm currently a volunteer with Rehoboth and Bloom, a beautification gardening program here in our city. I volunteer one day a week at the Community Resource Center Food Rescue Program. So those are all outside of what I'm doing as a city commissioner.
So, you know, you live here, you're retired here, so that's kind of what you focus on, is making sure Rehoboth Beach is a better place for everyone.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you're interested, Roman, there's really kind of three pervasive themes that I'm running on, mm-hmm. and that have really guided my work these almost 3 years as a commissioner since I was elected. And one is to work to continuously and very intentionally preserve our unique residential neighborhoods. Quality of life for residents here is very important. People have invested a lot to live in this beautiful beach community. We are only 1 square mile. We're not expanding. And so we need to take care of what we have. And that kind of segues into my second theme, and that is protecting our natural environment. We are so fortunate to have not only our beach, our boardwalk, and the Atlantic Ocean, but we have two freshwater lakes in our community, which is very unique for a beach community. And then we have the Lewis-Rehoboth Canal. And so we have these incredible waterways and bodies of water. We are a tree city. We are promoting pollinator gardens. We're doing all we can to keep the health of our lakes, beach, and ocean at a standard where it needs to be. I've been on the Tree and Green Infrastructure Committee, as well as I chair the Environment Committee. And, you know, we're just driven to preserve green space and preserve our trees. We've been working hard, and we still have a ways to go to really fix our stormwater runoff problem that we have that, can create toxic runoff into our lakes and our bodies of water. And then that leads me into the third theme, which is promoting ethical, transparent, open government. I have worked hard to elicit broad participation on issues, to strengthen communication, and to be very available to residents and others here that have a concern, that have an issue, or that want to share things.
Yeah. So sounds like your three priorities are, you know, preserving that Rehoboth Beach aesthetic in the neighborhoods, protecting the environment, and also promoting an ethical and transparent government in the city.
Yes, exactly, Roman. You got that right. Thank you.
Yeah. You know, lastly, obviously, you're running for reelection. You've kind of highlighted some of the focuses that you want to focus on as a commissioner in Rehoboth Beach. Why don't you tell me, you know, what sort of issues do you see facing Rehoboth Beach in the next 3 years, and what kind of things do you want to tackle to, you know, fix those issues?
Sure. Thanks, Roman. Yeah, from my perspective, kind of the number one issue and priority is achieving a really positive balance between the various identities in our small community. Not all small communities have multiple identities, but we have just beautiful residential neighborhoods. we have a thriving and prosperous small business community, mostly small family-owned businesses. And we have a very much needed and exciting resort community. These three identities, you know, can certainly compete for things, but I think being very intentional, very purposeful in achieving, you know, a fair and really positive outcome-based approach to balancing the identities is critical for the future. It's my sense that all three of the identities kind of depend on each other, that it's an interdependent community. And the residents are going to do better when our downtown business community does well. Our downtown community, business community does well when we have a strong and thriving resort business. And so the three are really dependent on each other. And one of the big roles, I think, of our city government and of the elected folks like me is to pay close attention to this balance and make sure that that what's happening is in the best interest for both short and long range quality of life in our city of Rehoboth Beach. So for me, that's kind of the overarching, and then a lot of things fall out of that big umbrella in terms of the direction to go. But you know, around those three themes that I named, you know, things are critical. Critical issues such as, having a code that regulates how houses can be built, so that we're preserving green space, we're preserving trees, that houses do not get out of proportion to, the sensible size of things in our city. You know, to make sure that businesses are following code, and that we do all that we can to be welcoming to small businesses. There's a place for chain stores, and I think that's out on Route 1 and in other places, not in our downtown community. You know, we want to have unique businesses, unique restaurants, bars, and shops, so that people want to be here. You know, we're competing with coastal communities up and down the East Coast in Delaware, Jersey, Maryland, Virginia. And people have options in terms of where to go to spend their hard-earned money. We want folks to come here. And so we have to have some unique attractions that are part of the quality of life in Rehoboth Beach, that people want to come and use our beach, use our boardwalk, eat in our restaurants, shop in our stores here.
Yeah, so it sounds like the most important thing is maintaining that balance between the residents of the town, the businesses, and the tourists or the resort part of the community, and ensuring that all of them mesh well together, because, you know, maintaining that identity seems really important for the city. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today, Richard Byrne.
My pleasure, Roman. Thank you for reaching out and paying attention to us.
Thanks to Rehoboth Board of Commissioners candidate Richard Byrne and our Roman Battaglia for their time on The Green this week. We'll have interviews with the other candidates in the coming weeks and make them all available at DelawareRepublic.org. The Rehoboth Board of Commissioners election is August 14th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Rehoboth Beach Convention Center. Absentee voting forms are available at the city's website. And there's more to come on The Green, including the latest story from our Delaware Community Foundation intern, Caleb Williams. That's next on The Green, here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. This summer, Delaware Public Media joined the Delaware Community Foundation and other First State media outlets in launching a new journalism internship program. And this week, we have a new story from our intern, Kayla Williams. Small businesses, especially minority-owned ones, can have a harder time supporting themselves financially. And that was seen even more clearly during the COVID pandemic, which had a disproportionate impact on minority-owned businesses. And Kayla reports the recently formed Delaware Black Chamber of Commerce is offering a new way to help them.
The Black Chamber of Commerce has signed up 265 members statewide since launching in September 2020. Its founder, president, and CEO, Ayana Khan, says she created it to help small minority-owned businesses overcome disadvantages that leave many struggling to thrive.
There are some businesses that are basically stuck because there have been several systemic barriers in place that were not allowing them the opportunities that they need to get to the next level in business.
The Black Chamber's latest effort to assist these businesses is called Enrich Delaware. Khan says it's a national curriculum created by the nonprofit Interise.
They work with several chambers of commerce throughout the country. So we're bringing it here to Delaware to help grow small businesses.
The program has already been used in 85 other markets. Khan says this is a bit more focused than some of the other work the chamber does. Focusing on 20 businesses for 7 months, over the course of about 100 hours, they'll spend time in classrooms learning and working with CEOs and mentoring groups to get tools they can use.
So the curriculum is awesome. We're going to have three sessions on just business strategies, assessment, setting the state for growth. There's going to be two major CEOs, mentoring groups, as well as live cases. There's going to be resources on getting what they need to grow. There's three sessions on that. The finance piece will be balancing cash flow and basically managing their bottom line. And marketing and sales, how to build profitability and sales. And then just putting it all together.
The Black Chamber of Commerce hopes Enrich Delaware can build on work it's already doing with minority-owned small businesses, such as Elite Feet in Middletown.
Drop arch, as they call it. Okay. You see how they're leaning in? Yeah. So she needs to be in a stability shoe, a shoe that has a medial post, something that you can't really fold up like this,
okay,
as opposed to a shoe that she has. You can just fold up like this.
What we do is we look at people's feet by using gait analysis, looking at their arches. We measure people's feet, both feet, because all feet are not created equal. We basically choose the best shoe for the right you.
That's Elite Feet co-founder Jason Hunt. He and his wife have been in business for about 7 years and joined the Black Chamber of Commerce when it launched nearly 2 years ago. Hunt says joining the Black Chamber has already paid dividends for them during the pandemic.
The chamber has been very, very instrumental in us because they were helping us to get money through the PPPs and all those other loans and grants that was afforded by the state. So we love the Black Chamber. Ms. Khan is doing a great job, outstanding job. She's such an advocate. So we appreciate her and everything that the chamber does.
The Delaware Black Chamber says its partnership with SmartBiz and Customers Bank allowed it to help 84 businesses receive nearly $361,000 in PPP loans. But Khan says that work and advocacy are not just about helping businesses themselves. It's also about helping them build the communities they're in.
It's very important for small businesses and Black businesses to give back to the community because in our communities, in those underserved communities, there's lack of resources. There may be crime, there may be, health disparities and different things. So, they say the Black dollar doesn't, circulate in our communities. It only circulates in our communities for, a short period of time versus our other communities. So it's important that, these businesses give back and help the communities, help the youth, give back, educate, mentor, provide resources, supplies, whatever is needed to boost their community, because that will build generational wealth.
And Hunt says when businesses like his thrive, they can do more to give back to their communities.
I do a thing called Cuts for Kids, right? Basically, we give out free book bags, free haircuts, and school supplies for kids in this area. Obviously, people supported me. I'm able to do community events like that. So we do a Black History, Black History essay every year as well. So we give out prizes. So we're able to use the money that we get, and obviously to do things, to fund things that are going to be, impact our community. And also I hire people that look like us. So
The Delaware Black Chamber of Commerce is holding an open house on July 19th for businesses interested in the Enrich Delaware program. Information on that is available at the Chamber's website, debcc.org. The deadline to apply for the program is August 22nd. It begins September 7th. Kayla Williams, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Kayla. A reminder, Kayla is our Delaware Community Foundation journalism intern, and this piece was produced with support of a grant from the Delaware Community Foundation. For more information, visit delcf.org/journalism. And we wrap up The Green next with Arts Playlist, which offers more on the latest exhibition at the Historic Odessa Foundation. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. There's a new exhibition at the Historic Odessa Foundation. It's called American Impressions, Plain Air Paintings. And the artist is Jacqueline Beam from Centerville. On this week's Arts Playlist, Beam joins Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele to discuss her background, her art, and this latest exhibit of 63 plain air oil paintings.
Give me some background first, and then we'll delve into what the exhibit has to offer.
Oh, sure. Well, I'm a local plein air painter. I was born and raised in the Brandywine Valley and have lived on the East Coast all my life. I do paint nationally in juried shows, but I love the Brandywine Valley. And so most of my paintings are really from outside my back door. There's beauty everywhere you look. And so I try to capture that on canvas and then share it with others.
Why did your love of the Brandywine Valley even get started, Jacqueline?
Maybe it's because I was born here, but also there's a long history of art on the East Coast with not only the Chester County artists, but also the Bucks County artists. And they were certainly some of the preeminent impressionists in the country. And then some moved to the West Coast. And, of course, the Impressionist movement then started there. But they were mostly as a result of in this Philadelphia, Chester County, Bucks County area because they could travel freely back and forth to Europe. And, of course, you know, the Impressionists there were part of their influence as well. So it was really a very broad artistic community, if you consider across the Atlantic as well as the East Coast here in America.
You paint the outdoors, correct?
Yes, I love being outside.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, first of all, when you're outside, you have the natural light. And there's nothing like having the natural light right in the objects in front of you to understand the atmospheric surrounds, the true colors, the local color. And for me, I love being outside because I love listening to the birds and everything that nature has to provide. It's sort of the whole experience, environmental experience. It's very holistic. It's very hard for me to paint inside, to be honest with you. Even on a rainy day, I'm still looking out windows. But it's a great way to learn how to paint.
Let's talk about the title of this latest exhibit, the new exhibit of 63 plein air oil paintings by yourself. Jacqueline Beam is who we're speaking to, if you're just joining us. What's the name of the exhibit?
American Impressions. And the reason it's called American Impressions is because, well, all the paintings are from America. I am an American, proudly raised and patriotic. And the impressions are what I see in the landscape. And I think impressions offer the viewer a chance to interpret and understand America as they see it.
So why don't you tell people about, there's 63 paintings in this exhibit. What are some of your favorite ones?
That's a hard one. Typically, I guess my favorite is the one I'm working on at the time, but one of the paintings is called Coursing Through. It's one of my larger paintings, which I rarely do, actually, because as a plein air painter, you typically paint smalls that'll fit on a shod box that you can carry into the woods or wherever. It's a 30 by 40 of a snow scene, and it's a little tributary right off the Brandywine River near Hagley Museum. And I love snow scenes. I love painting in the snow. So So I think that would be one of my favorites.
What's the longest time you've spent outside in the snow painting, Jacqueline?
Well, all day. Until it gets dark. I might go back and sit in my car for a little bit, but pretty much I'll spend the whole day outside if I can, because we get snow so rarely here that when it does snow, I have to make the best of it.
All right. Can you think of another one of your favorites in the 63 that you have in the exhibit?
I have to think about what's in the exhibit. My paintings of Winnetur are in the exhibit. I love Winnetur. It's down the street from me, and it has so much history. Anything along the Brandywine is there.
Now, why do you use oil to paint?
Well, I use oil to paint I use conservator oil. I think that's very important because oil painting has certainly withstood the test of time. And I'm very much into history and preservation. I believe that, we learn a lot from our history, and then we also produce history for, upcoming generations. So I use all conservator oils. I paint on conservator grade oil prime Belgian linen on Baltic birch panels, which really is the best you can buy and, used by folks who are highly concerned about not only the environment but also preserving these images for generations to come. So oil is substantive to me. I mean, you can feel the thick paint. There are times when I use a palette knife to apply paint to give it more depth and importance. I think there's a tactile thing about oil for me, but I also want to say that it produces such fabulous colors. It's capable of that because of, the time-tested history of it. And also, it is what I use is conservation grade. Not all is, but I use conservation grade oil. So I know that this will go to the children and grandchildren of future generations.
Have you ever used anything besides oil to paint?
Yes, that's a great question. I have used other things. A couple months ago, I experimented a bit with gouache, which is a water-soluble paint, and also I have done a few small watercolor sketches. But the bulk, 99.9% of my work, is in oils because, again, of the substantive nature that I see in oils and feel as I paint.
I gotcha. All right, I'm going to put you on the spot again. I put you on the spot already by asking you some of your favorite paintings in this new exhibit. Do you have any favorite artists?
Oh, I do. There are so many really fine artists, not only from the past but current. From the past, I love Sorolla and Sargent, Thayer, Benson, Frank Benson, who painted in Maine. He really is a painter that shows a lot of light and he's a quintessential impressionist painter. Presently, I like C.W. Mundy and Huang Ho. Some of the painters who have a little bit of an edge to their work. They're not certainly traditionalists or realists, and they're not, Mondrian contemporary. They're somewhere in between. They're representational artists that give you a hint of what's happening, but you are brought into the painting because of what it is that you can see and think about and try to understand.
I was going to ask you what the common theme was, because you threw a few names in there that I've never heard of, and I was going to ask you what the common theme among those artists were.
Okay. I think the common theme is that, to me, these are artists that bear their soul. They're not copying or doing anything anybody else is doing, and yet you can tell that they certainly are part of a particular sect or genre of artists. All of the ones that I mentioned work in oil. Maybe they do some other things too, but their seminal works are definitely in oil. The ones that I mentioned, like Sorolla, he sometimes used a limited palette, 3 or 4 colors, but produced these incredible luminous paintings that continue today to be beautiful. Benson is one of those. He was an impressionist, so probably a lesser-known artist, just as you said, you didn't know him. But if you check out Frank Benson's work, he painted a lot in Maine. He was on an island there, and he often painted his daughters. So when you look at his work, it'll look like, a Sargent or even a Renoir. I shouldn't say Renoir. He's a little looser, but, he has his own style. But I mentioned him to somebody a couple months ago and who had never heard of him, but when she looked him up, she was like, oh, my gosh, I've seen his work in the National Gallery. And so that sort of, drew her in to learn more about his work. The ones in Buck County I love. I didn't mention them, but certainly Garber and Sauter. Sauter painted a lot of nocturnes in Bucks County, and I like that those scenes because I'm familiar with them. I lived, you know, in this southern Pennsylvania area.
All right, we're talking to Jacqueline Beam. She's the latest artist to have an exhibit on display at the Historic Odessa Foundation. Jacqueline, what is the takeaway? What do you want people, viewers, to take away when they go through your exhibit?
I'd like people to go to Odessa and enjoy the entire experience, not just the exhibit, but everything around it. I feel like this particular exhibit of local art and really documenting history plays so well in the whole Odessa experience. And some of the framing that is done, as well as the subject matter, certainly fits with the stories. And I want to say the time period, not just from before, but now. So I think it's a total experience when you see the local scenes and the art. In combination with visiting the houses and the tavern, plan to spend a day or two because certainly I know that when I go to exhibits, I have to see them like twice because the first time it's an overall look and you sort of get a sense of the unity of the pieces. But when you go back, you can delve into them a little bit more closely, pick out ones that you like, and even maybe on a third time, you'll see something different that you did not see on the first and second visit.
Thanks to artist Jacqueline Beam and our Kelly Steele for joining us on Arts Playlist. Beam's American Impressions runs at the Historic Odessa Foundation through August 30th. More information is available at historicodessa.org. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors Eileen Dalabrida and John Hurdle, Delaware Community Foundation journalism intern Kayla Williams, and Delaware Public Media's Roma Battaglia and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. The Green is taking its summer vacation next week, so we'll see you again in 2 weeks here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.